the rules around deducting things. So what allows us to deduct anything? Well, the Internal Revenue Code, that's IRC, I didn't define that there, but the IRC Section 162 says that someone who is engaged in a trade or business is allowed to deduct expenses that are ordinary and necessary to that business. So they don't technically define trade or business in the Internal Revenue Code, but it's common law has defined it as an activity that you carry on in an attempt to make a profit or what you do to as your own livelihood. What are ordinary and necessary expenses? Well, it depends on who you are and what you do. Things that are ordinary and necessary in my business probably wouldn't be ordinary and necessary in yours. So it's a facts and circumstances test, and it looks to specifically what industry are you in and what's common to that industry. When and where do you deduct expenses? Well, in part, where you deduct things depends on whether you're self-employed or whether you're an employee. If you're self-employed, then you report your net results on Schedule C, the Schedule of Self-Employment. You deduct your expenses directly against your net income, against your income, and net it to come down to a bottom line, which is then considered your gross income. It's kind of a misnomer in a way. When people say, "What is the gross income for a self-employed person?" It's your net income on that comes from the Schedule C. If you're an employee, you deduct it in a different place entirely. You deduct it on Form 2106, unreimbursed employee business expenses, and you have to meet a threshold before you can deduct it. So let me give you an example. If I were an employee and I made $100,000, and I had, you know, some unreimbursed employee business expenses, I would first have to be able to meet the itemized deduction threshold because miscellaneous employee business expenses are an itemized deduction. What is that? I think it's about $6,000 this year, which is for a single person, your standard deduction is about $6,000. Every year they change it, and I've forgotten the exact amount this year. Maybe it's $5,800, $5,900, something like that. So when my itemized deductions exceed that amount, then it's beneficial for me to itemize. So the rule for unreimbursed employee business expenses say, first you have to meet 2% of your adjusted gross income threshold. So if I made $100,000, then that would mean that when my miscellaneous employee business expenses exceeded $2,000, I could start to deduct on that. So if I had $3,000 of expenses, I would get a $1,000 deduction. So being an employee means that you're gonna take a haircut on your expenses being able to deduct those. The other thing is that unfortunately, if you're making a larger sum than that, miscellaneous deductions, itemized deductions, are an add back for purposes of the alternative minimum tax. So if you're making enough, you don't get any benefit from deducting them at all. When do you deduct things? Most of you are cash basis taxpayers. I don't know anyone that is, well, I do know some companies that are accrual basis taxpayers, but generally an individual is a cash basis taxpayer, meaning you deduct it when you pay it. And there's a little hiccup to that, which says that you deduct it if you put it on a credit card, you deduct it when you charge it to the card, not necessarily when you pay the card off. Okay, so that's why everyone goes out and puts everything on their credit card in December so that they can deduct it this year, not next. So what documentation are you required to keep? So for any expense that you're deducting, theoretically, you have the burden of proof to have an invoice and the proof of payment. Now, the IRS says that you're not required to keep receipts for travel-related expenses that are less than $75. But then again, they also have the authority to say, you know what, I don't believe you. I don't care that our rules say that you don't have to have receipts for less than $75. You've claimed too many expenses that are less than $75, so if you don't have receipts for that, I'm not going to allow you to deduct it. So I'll just say that it's not required, but it is recommended. So people ask me, well, is it enough that I have my credit card statement? And the answer is no, it's not. Maybe, depends on what the expense is. If you're claiming that you have a meals and entertainment expense and you've got a $25 charge from a restaurant or Starbucks, probably that's enough. But, you know, if I've got a something from Staples, maybe it's good enough, maybe it's not. I could buy other things at Staples, or let's say Best Buy. I could buy a personal TV set at Best Buy, or I could buy, you know, computer equipment. If you don't have the receipt for it, they can disallow it. So keep receipts with your credit card statements. Yes, question. Oh, that is a very good question. The question is how long do I have to keep my receipts? So there are two statute of limitations. Well, there are actually three. I'll make the easy one. If you ever commit fraud, there is no statute of limitations. They can go back forever. So fraud, no statute of limitations. The regular statute of limitations say the IRS has 3 years in which to audit you. Which means, what does that mean? So if my 2012 return was due April 15th, 2013, the IRS can audit me up until April 15th, 2016, at which point then the regular statute of limitations has run. There is a second statute of limitations called the substantial omission statute of limitations. And that statute of limitations is 6 years. And basically the rule says that if you omitted something or you deducted something in your return that is more than 25% of what you reported as your gross income, the IRS can go back for 6 years. So most people say keep your receipts for 7 years, you know, just in case somehow the IRS has figured out a way to impose the substantial omission statute of limitations. But at a minimum, 3 years. Yes. Digital copies are acceptable. The question was, is that original receipts or is it digital copies and digital copies are acceptable? That was it, right? Yes. Substantial omission is that's a term of art in accounting, and the term of art means that I reported a certain amount of money in my tax return, and they got another 1099 that says that I should have reported $20,000 more than the $100,000 I did report. So all that means is that the IRS can then choose to audit and look at everything in that return for 6 years as opposed to just the 3 years. So for documentation, there are certain types of expenses that the IRS considers that are subject to abuse more frequently than other types of expenses, so they have a higher substantiation level on that. Travel and entertainment, gifts, and what they call listed property. So with travel and entertainment, not only do you have to have the receipt, for example, that proves that you actually incurred this expense, but with entertainment or meals in particular, you have to be able to say who did you have that meal with. With gifts, there are specific limitations on that. With listed property, and this is in one point where your question is addressed, is listed property is computers, cell phones, certain other types of expenses where they say, you know what, these types of expenses, we know that you have it for personal use as well, so you have to substantiate how much of it is business and how much of it is personal. Contemporaneous documentation, what I mean by that is in terms of, for example, let's say mileage. If I deduct auto expenses for my car, I theoretically have an obligation to keep a log to say how much business miles did I drive and how much were personal. And I'll just say that if you're audited and you go back and recreate that log after the fact, the IRS doesn't find that very persuasive at all. In fact, they consider that you made it up. So keeping records as you go at the same time is far more persuasive than creating them after the fact. So I'm gonna list some of the or take a question. The question is it I'll actually address auto expenses a little bit more later on. But the rule about keeping a log, that would be true whether you're using the actual mileage method or the standard mileage rate, if you will. But having some measure of business usage is important. So what's a deductible meal and entertainment? Well, the IRS says that there are you can deduct meals and entertainment under one of two standards. There's a directly related standard, and there is an associated with standard. The directly related standard, the main reason that you're having a meeting with the person is for business purposes. You're engaged in business during the meeting, and that you have more than a general expectation of generating income from having this meeting. The associated with standard says that, oh, hey, I've had a client in from out of town, and we engaged in business all day, and we went out to dinner afterwards. So it is an activity that you engage in either before or after your business meeting, but it's associated with the active conduct of trade or business. So what does this tell you? This tells you that the IRS has a higher standard than probably what a lot of us think of as business meals. My experience with this is don't be greedy. There's an old saying in the accounting business, and maybe it's in a lot of other businesses, bulls and bears make money, pigs get slaughtered. And what that means is don't deduct every meal that you go out to. I had to defend someone in an audit where I swear every meal that I actually didn't prepare the return. Just know that. I didn't prepare the return. I only had to defend it afterwards. He deducted every meal that he ate during the entire year. And there were probably 2 to 3 meals a day that went on this log. So when I'm sitting in across from the auditor trying to say, let's talk reasonable here. And the auditor looked at me and said, reasonable? Why don't we start with zero? Zero's reasonable in my view. I was shocked into silence, and we settled on a middling number. But where you've got 3 meals a day being deducted, or 2 to 3 meals a day for the entire year, that's clearly unreasonable. When I can show, here's a personal card with all of these charges that were not deducted, then that's reasonable. Theoretically, you are responsible for telling the IRS who you had a meal with. As a practical matter, does it come up that way? Not that often. It's more, we're looking at the total, we're looking at whether the total looks reasonable, we're looking at whether you deducted every meal that you ate. So, telephone expenses. This comes up in every audit that I have. The first question that they ask me is, cell phone, how much do they allocate to personal use? And it's sort of, as a rule, even if I think that my clients are, 100% of their cell phone should be deductible, as a practical matter, I say deduct 75%, 80%, take something as personal, because they're going to ask that question every single time. What's the rule in a home office is if you have in the old sort of old fogey method like me, where you have a landline as well as a cell phone, the IRS used to say, that the first home line, the first landline in your home was non-deductible because you would have a phone anyway, if you lived at home. Now, that's not necessarily true. But if you have a landline in your home and you're deducting it, the first line is non-deductible. You're allowed to deduct long distance on that if you can say that this long distance was business-related. If you had a second line that was entirely dedicated for fax back in the old days, when people actually fax things, then that was 100% deductible. Equipment. So generally, if you buy equipment that is for business, bless you. If you buy equipment that you're using for business, that's deductible. There are certain things that they call listed property that they believe that are susceptible to abuse, that you would use them for personal reasons as well as business reasons. Then they want you to track what is business and personal usage. As a practical matter, they really don't assert that for computer equipment. They used to, years ago, they used to assert that as kind of a a question, you know, is, well, have you allocated something to personal use for the computer? That doesn't come up as much anymore. They do that on the cell phone, but not so much on the computer anymore. Now, is the equipment necessary? And this is under the heading of I am self-employed, or no, this is more under the heading of I am an employee and I am getting a W-2, and I am also incurring unreimbursed employee business expenses. It's a problem if you're going to deduct a computer there, because their question is, you don't have a computer at your job, they don't provide you one at work. Well, you say, well, yeah, they provide me a computer at my office. Then why are you deducting this computer? Well, I do some research on it at home. That doesn't rise to the level of what the IRS believes is necessary. So if you're going to be deducting equipment, you probably are better off in waiting and buying it in the year that you're going to have Schedule C, that you're going to have 1099 or self-employment income, because you may get audited, or you may have a problem if you're deducting it when you're an employee. Auto expenses. So there are two different methods that you can deduct auto expenses under. The first method is the standard mileage rate. And it's kind of, in some ways, it's the easier method, which is basically all I have to do is you know, keep track in a log of how many miles I drove for business. You know, maybe I drove 1,000 miles, and then I get a $500 deduction or $560 deduction for that by applying the standard mileage rate times the number of miles that I drove. The other method is the actual expense method, where you say, I originally bought the car for this amount, and I'm allowed a depreciation allowance on that. I also paid gas, repairs, and maintenance, bought new tires, paid insurance on it. So I take the total of all of those expenses, and then I say, okay, now what is the business percentage as what is the business use as the percentage of total use? I get a percentage, and I say 50%, and I say, okay, now I take 50% of the total actual expenses, and that's the deduction that I'm allowed. There's a little bit more record-keeping involved in that, but it could yield a higher deduction for you. Again, it's very important to track the business use of it contemporaneously and not create it after the fact. Yes? That's different. So this is this idea is if I am using my personal auto, and if you're renting a car for production, 100% deductible. So it's only that's a very good qualification. This rule only really applies on your own personal auto that you're deducting for business purposes. If you're using a vehicle for a rented vehicle for production, that's 100% deductible. Yes. That comes up in just a moment. So the quick question is, and I do mention this, but I'll go ahead now that you've raised the question. So what local transportation costs are deductible? The short answer is if you are an employee, none. Your general cost of commuting to and from your place of employment is not deductible. If you commute from during the day, like if you go to a job site or a location there and you're not reimbursed by your employer, then that is potentially an unreimbursed employee business expense. If you, for example, go to the office and you have to take a cab because you're carrying equipment, and you're not reimbursed by your employer, that potentially is a deductible expense of an employee. If you're self-employed, that the answer is completely different. If you're self-employed, you're considered, your place of business is your home. So whenever you leave the front door, your cost of commuting are deductible. So, yes. So the question is it acceptable for someone who is working to bill you for their cost of commutation? If you pay it, sure. Yes, it is perfectly acceptable. If their place of employment is their home, since they're self-employed, So their cost of getting to and from work is a deductible expense. So if you agree as an employer to pay that, then it's deductible to you. So so it's sort of what will the market bear? And if I can get the person to reimburse me for my cost of travel, then absolutely it's deductible. Any other? Yes. It is perfectly acceptable for your employer, if you are renting equipment to them, it is perfectly acceptable for them to issue you a 1099 that reimburses you box one rents for your equipment. It's where it's problematic is for your employer who's issuing you a W-2 to issue you a 1099 miscellaneous that says you have box seven non-employee compensation. It's okay to do the, you know, I'm renting your equipment, so I'm paying you. Yes. And in your case, if you have to schlep the equipment to the office, then yes, that would be a deductible expense that could be deducted on your rents. So the question is, what if the employer erroneously lists my compensation for renting this equipment as box seven non-employee comp and instead of box one rents? Then you go back to your employer and you say, I need a corrected 1099. You made a mistake on my 1099. And you ask them to reissue it. Yes. The difference is that technically the way that income is reported for rents, if I'm receiving compensation for the rental of my equipment, it is reported in a different place. Ann and I were actually just talking about this. Ann says that she has reported it on Schedule C but not subjected it to self-employment tax. I typically report it on Schedule E, which is rental income. And rental income is not subject to self-employment tax. So if you're receiving a box one rents, that's far favorable. That's more favorable to you than receiving box seven non-employee comp, where you're going to owe self-employment tax on that. So if you have an LLC and you are self-employed and you're reporting your income on Schedule C, then yes, your place of employment is your home. That's where your business is. So whenever you leave your home and you take transportation somewhere, that is a deductible expense on your Schedule C. The cost of commuting there, so if I have a W-2 and I have a 1099, the W-2 job, I'm not allowed to deduct my cost of commuting there. That's just the period, end of story. Okay, yes. So the question that has come up is, I was reimbursed by by the production that I was working for my for reimbursed expenses. Sometimes you can get a 1099 just for the expenses. Sometimes you can get a 1099 for my services and my expenses. So if you get a 1099 that includes expenses that you reimbursed, you deduct those expenses on your Schedule C. So let's say that I got $1,350. $1,000, 1099, $1,000 of that was for services, and then $350 was for, I rented a car, I did something else, you know, but I got $350. So I would report on the first line of my Schedule C, $1,350, and then I would have a line down below that said, you know, travel, equipment rental, something, $350 of expense, and then I would end up paying tax on the net. I'll say as a practical matter in this day and age, now that digital receipts are the standard, that that receipts that has less of an impact. We tend to be, I've looked at the rules on it, and I'll just say that as a practical matter, people do it inconsistently. Some people pick up your expenses and 1099 you on the full amount. Some people only pick up your services and 1099 you on that amount. You as the person who's receiving the 1099 should really look at that and say, what am I getting 1099'd on? Because I want to make sure that I tell my accountant that this includes $350 of reimbursed expenses, and I want you to make sure that you deduct those expenses against it. Yes. So the question that arose is that I work for someone. They gave me an allowance for the use of my computer. My computer ended up being damaged, and so the way that they made up for that was by adding a couple of extra days to my 1099 amount, and I bought another computer. Well, the short answer is that I'll point out a couple of things. We'll get to one of them a little bit later in the slide, which talks about accountable and non-accountable plans. And I'll say more about that then. But if they're paying you for the use of your computer, they could 1099 you in a separate box that says box one rents. But or if they didn't, if they just gave you one lump sum, then what you want to do is first, your old computer, you should be able to depreciate that on your Schedule C and say, I'm taking an allowance for the use of this computer to the extent that you haven't deducted it before. The second thing is that now that you've used the money to buy a new computer, you should be deducting that computer on this year's taxes. So buying that computer will then allow you to offset the extra money that they gave you. Yes. Okay. So you've raised some very interesting questions. I live in New Jersey, and I am renting a space in New York, either an office space or an equipment rent, you know, or a storage site where I'm storing equipment. So that's interesting because renting space in New York City gives you nexus with this jurisdiction, which suddenly means that you could be subject to tax in New York City because you either have an office here or you're renting storage space here. So that's kind of the, just as an aside. But if your principal place of business is your home office, then commuting to and from that is a very interesting question. Because now the question becomes, if it's an office, hasn't your principal place of business moved to this office? Potentially your commutation costs to and from this space now might be non-deductible if this is your principal place of business. If, on the other hand, this is a storage space and you periodically come to it to see about your equipment or to get something out of equipment, then, you know, the travel commutation there certainly would be deductible. But it's I guess, the question of, I'll just say, it is an audit red flag to deduct a home office deduction and also deduct rent on another location. So, yes, that do one or the other or not both. Okay. Education. Basic cost of qualifying in your field is non-deductible. Amounts paid to improve or enhance existing skills is deductible. What does that mean? I'll call it the accounting degree. I'll give you my story on that. So my cost to qualify in my field to be an accountant, to potentially be a CPA, I have to have 4 years of undergraduate school, a degree, and I have to work a certain amount of time in my field. So the basic cost of getting my qualifications to be an accountant are my undergrad degree. So none of my cost of the undergrad degree is deductible. Now, once I have gotten my undergraduate degree and have gotten a job in my field, I said, hey, wait a minute, I want to enhance my skills. I want to know more about taxes because, you know, I worked in audit for years. So the cost of getting my graduate degree was completely deductible, but the cost of the undergrad degree is not. Now, sometimes this arises, and I've actually had this come up on audit, where somebody who, let's say, works on Wall Street, decides that they're going to get an MBA. The basic question is, well, wait a minute, is an MBA the minimum qualification to do your job? If that's the case, then your MBA is not deductible. So it really depends on what's the minimum qualification to work in your field. Home office. When can I deduct a home office? So I'll just tell you hands down that sometimes there is the odd case where you can be a W-2 employee and have a home office. Let's say that you work for a company that's based in California. They don't have any offices in New York. Potentially, you could deduct a home office, but guaranteed you're going to get audited. So, you know, guarantee. Short answer, if you've got a W-2 and you're deducting a home office, you will be audited. For a self-employed individual, what are the qualifications for deducting a home office? The space has to be used regularly and exclusively. Exclusively is a key word here. To either see clients or customers or be used to conduct administrative activities, and you do not have an outside location. The rule years ago before this was very egregious. The rule basically was that it had to be the place where you saw your customers or clients. And there was a doctor who actually took this case, all the way to the Supreme Court. And this guy, the facts and circumstances in his case were, he was a doctor that worked, he was an anesthesiologist that worked in probably four different hospitals. He didn't have an office in any single hospital. But that's where he administered anesthesia to his patients. But he had a home office, and he had a space that was dedicated in his home, a separate room that he used only for that purpose. And he did all of his billing activities there. And the Supreme Court said, you know, your case is really compelling, but unfortunately the rules say, what is your place of business where you see your customers? And you see your customers or your clients in a hospital. So no, you don't get a home office deduction. So Congress went back and changed that to say, okay, so you see your customers outside of your home office, but you don't have an administrative place, a place where you do your billing, a place you do your research, or a place where you conduct other significant administrative activities, then you can deduct a home office there. But it cannot be that you go and you have access to a computer and a space and, you know, that you have an office, and then you decide you also do some stuff at home as well. So it's got to be you can have no other outside location where you can conduct those same activities. Yes. Union dues are certainly a deductible expense. Yes. Local transportation, we went through these. Expenses while temporarily away from home on business. When you are engaged, when you are an employee and you work on a job and you work away from your home location, expenses that aren't necessarily deductible when you're at home might become deductible when you're away. I call this the dry cleaning rule. So dry cleaning when you're at home is never deductible, but if, for example, you're away and you have to have your clothes laundered because you're away from home, they become deductible. The key thing is temporary versus indefinite. Temporary means that your employment is expected to last less than a year. If it's expected to last more than a year, then the IRS considers you to have changed your tax home, and expenses are no longer deductible. A great example of this is I had a friend who was who moved to LA to do a pilot, and she, until the pilot got picked up, she was temporarily away from home on business, because it was unclear whether she was going to be gone more than a year. Once it got picked up for a series and the show got renewed and she was going to be on the show until the show was canceled, her tax home moved. So at that point, she could no longer deduct any of those expenses. But as long as it's less than a year, then you can deduct meals, lodging, transportation, baggage, phone, etc. Things that wouldn't necessarily be deductible if you were just at home. So accountable versus non-accountable plans. I threw this in because it kind of addresses that question of getting 1099'd on something. So an accountable plan is, I have an employer, I'm on a W-2, and they say, you know, Nancy, submit certain expenses to me, and I will write you a check to reimburse you. Or if you're away from home, like, I used to, when I was on audits, I would have to go and spend a few days at a client, and so they would give me a meal allowance for those days. As long as they're saying that because you're away for X number of days and you're getting this per diem, that's considered an accountable plan. And that money paid to you, receiving a meals and incidental per diem, is not taxable. So any money that you get back is non-taxable. For non-accountable plan, on the other hand, it's considered... They don't require any substantiation from you. They're just giving you an allowance, and that is taxable to you. So if they give you $100 per month for the use of your computer, or they give you $100 per month for the use of your cell phone, and you're not required to submit any expenses, any copies of receipts to prove that, then that is taxable to you, and they're required to either include it in your W-2 or issue you a 1099. So it should be non-taxable. So the question is what about a pay stub? Theoretically, meal per diems, as long as they're within the governmental standards, theoretically, meal per diems should be non-taxable to you. They may have just kept it as a marker on your W-2, but it probably should not have been included in your box one wages. Other common deductions, gifts, they're limited to $25 per donee. So in other words, I can only give you one gift for the entire year for $25 and deduct it. The key is if you're giving a gift to somebody, you think of, who am I giving it to? Am I giving it to the entire office where there are 25 people that work there? Or am I giving it to you where there's one, you know, where I'm limited to $25? Cable TV, they want you to take some business percentage. They don't want you to deduct 100%. Research, Netflix, movies, et cetera, conferences and meetings. Clothing, the general rule is no. There are some exceptions. If it's not otherwise adaptable for personal use, I call this the nurse's UPS guy rule. So you wouldn't wear the UPS uniform to anywhere but work. So that's not otherwise adaptable for personal use. But if you're buying specialized clothing, hard hats, padded clothing, something like that that you're using on a job, that's different. Or I had an actor that would she went to award ceremonies and she would never wear one of those evening gowns for any other purpose. So we deducted those clothings. Gym, the IRS says never, unless it's prescribed by a doctor for physical therapy purposes. The last slide is just on know that you're now required to have health insurance. There are penalties if you don't have coverage. There's reporting that you have to do in your tax return to reconcile it. And there is a fact sheet on the IRS website that can give you more info on it if you have any questions about that. So that concludes my presentation. I can take a couple of questions, maybe? Or okay, yes, you. You cannot deduct services, period, end of story. So, wait, did I make myself clear? No. No, just kidding. The answer is let's say that if you volunteer for a nonprofit organization and you incur out-of-pocket expenses, you can deduct those as a charitable contribution. You can never deduct the value of your time. Services, the value of your service is non-deductible. If you're using equipment, the question is, have you deducted that equipment somewhere else? If you have, then you can't deduct it again. No double benefit on that. Yes. I call that the kitchen table rule. You cannot eat dinner off of it and then turn around and use it as your office. It has to be a space that's only for that purpose, so you can carve out a little space and have a desk there. I'll come back to you in a second. So believe it or not, I have actually had the IRS on an audit go to my taxpayer's home to look at their home office. They can do that. The answer is, again, don't be greedy. They won't do that if you're claiming 15% or 20%, but if you're claiming as much as 50%, they want to come and look at your space. So the question that is raised is, I'm purchasing equipment, and I have to, I'm recovering my costs. There are two ways in which you can recover the cost of equipment. If I'm deducting it, let's say that I'm deducting it as a self-employment expense on Schedule C, I can elect to expense and deduct 100% of the cost in this year, and that's called Section 179, expensing election, and I've chosen to deduct 100% of the cost. There are limitations on that, and sometimes those limitations say that, you have to have net income. If you don't have net income, you can't put yourself into a loss position. So if I choose that, then I might have to carry it over or something like that. So you report depreciation or the Section 179 expensing election on Form 4562, which is a depreciation schedule. If you're just depreciated, if you say that I'm going to take this depreciation percentage, sometimes the filing of the Form 4562 in years after you purchased it, Sometimes it's not mandatory that you put it in your return. Your accountant should be able to help you figure it out. But any year in which you actually place new property in service, 4562 is mandatory. Yes. Mailbox. So you're renting a mailbox. So what percentage of mailbox and phone service are deductible? So you're renting an outside mailbox? Is it for personal and business? Then 100% of that would be deductible. The cell phone, again, it's up to you to show what the business percentage is. And again, okay, if it's just for business purposes, then theoretically it's 100% deductible. Okay. To have an Outlook calendar and that you could print it out and keep it out, with your return after the end of the year, an Excel spreadsheet, something that you can just print out after the end of the year and keep it with your tax records. I'll take one more question and then the question of permanent residence is a very interesting question. In New York City, just to repeat, the question is I come to New York to shoot a pilot, and the pilot gets picked up, and I am going to come back. I do go home and spend a certain amount of time at my home location, a few months here, a few months there. The question of residency in New York City is, do I spend 183 days in New York, and do I have a permanent place of abode here? It's if you have a permanent place of abode and you spend more than half the year here, you are a New York City resident. It doesn't really matter if you still spend time in the other location. If you spend more than 6 months of the year here and you have a permanent place of abode, period, end of story, you're a New York City tax resident. Yes. So sales tax, so there's a question about sales tax. Sales tax is a destination tax, and if your customer is located, sales tax is also a tax that's assessed on tangible personal property. So if you are delivering a video disc to someone, then theoretically that disc is subject to sales tax. If, on the other hand, you are delivering something electronically via a file transfer protocol, that is not subject to sales tax. So only tangible personal property is subject to sales tax. But it's a destination tax, and only those customers in your jurisdiction, in New York State, are subject to sales tax if you only have nexus with New York. So if you have an out-of-state customer, then no sales tax. If they're a New York customer and you deliver electronically, no sales tax. But if you deliver tangible personal property, then potentially sales tax. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.